Hello and welcome to another episode of the Philosophy Exchange podcast. In this episode, we'll be asking what philosophy can teach economics and what economics can teach philosophy. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by three philosopher economists. Jorge.
Hello.
Francisca.
Hi.
And April.
Hello there.
And I'm Rob. So by way of a brief introduction, philosophy and economics have close historical connections. What we know as modern economics arguably emerged from philosophy in the 18th century, notably with the publication of The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. A less discussed fact is that Adam Smith's first book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, was about moral philosophy. Indeed, Smith is just one in a long line of famous economists, including Karl Marx, Friedrich Hayek, and Amartya Sen, who could equally be described as philosophers. And many philosophers have been influenced and inspired by economic ideas. For example, John Rawls, whose book, A Theory of Justice, contains the kind of supply and demand curves you might expect in a microeconomics textbook. In the present day, philosophy and economics have diverged to a large extent. They're mainly taught as distinct subjects at university. They have different methodologies, economics seeming often like a branch of applied maths, whereas philosophy, though it has a distinct argumentative structure, mostly uses words. The public tends to think of economists as focused on practical problem solving in areas like business, trade, and finance, and see philosophers as more contemplative thinkers who take a step back and consider abstract questions about truth, meaning, and reality. We think, however, that economics and philosophy still have a lot to learn from each other. And we're going to discuss in this episode three different areas: what moral philosophy can teach welfare economics, what philosophy of science can teach experimental economics, and what formalizing economics with maths can teach some areas of philosophy. So to kick us off, I think Francisca is going to talk to us about what moral philosophy can teach economics.
Thanks a lot, Rob, and thank you for having me on this podcast. It's just great to talk about how these two disciplines intersect. To kick it off with a brief quote, John Broome has said that economists do not always notice the differences between technical assumptions and moral principles. And as I'll be talking a bit about what moral philosophy can teach welfare economics, I think my biggest main message would be that it's important to make value judgments transparent. And that's something where economics can take philosophy as a much greater role model, and something that the discipline I feel has to improve upon. So whenever we take policy advice from economic studies, I think this is based on efficiency and equity. Yet in these studies, these notions are normally, very distinct notions of efficiency and welfare that are based on preference satisfaction and maybe an egalitarian view of equity. And those are the notions then that make their way into policy advice, even though there are alternatives out there and economists are not very transparent about that they're bringing these notions to the table. So I feel that there's really an importance in talking about what welfare actually means and what equity means in these contexts. So when we talk about welfare, we mostly in economics have the notion of preference satisfaction at the core of it. But there are many other notions that could make their way into it. We could talk about well-being, and this has indeed been adopted by a few people in the discourse around economics and how to better measure welfare and measure GDP, maybe. Some of you may heard about Bhutan having their gross national happiness index there, which is again debatable as to what notion of happiness they're measuring there. But there is some movement here, and certainly we could talk about how in certain policy contexts, such as in when people make choices about architecture and so forth, and this should be much more guided by the well-being that they take care of it rather than the preferences that come into it, as we all very well know that people do not always choose what makes them happy in the end. There are other approaches as well. Amartya Sen, one of the great examples of somebody who's a great philosopher and at the time a Nobel Prize winner in economics, has brought forward the capability approach, which some take to be an alternative welfare measure in development economics. So there may be contexts where we may be able to say preference satisfaction is not the absolute maxim here by which we want to go as policymakers, and we want to lend ourselves to results from happiness research. We want to lend ourselves to results from development research to guide our policy advice. And then if economists were also able to incorporate these other measures into their models, they could actually deliver pertinent policy advice that's not only tailored to those policymakers, politicians who want to improve this general notion of efficiency, the most of preference satisfaction, but want to put forward alternative measures by making people happier when it comes to architectural design in their cities, by ensuring that, for example, policy advice in foreign policy does not only yield at the maximization of preferences. I believe that one reason why this is not happening, that economics is making their normative premises very visible, is the marginalist revolution that we've been going through in the mathematical revolution, where economics has kind of changed their self-perception and tried to mimic natural sciences and physics and mathematics, seeing themselves as strictly positivist and as if there were no normative element in economics. But of course, we know that when we talk about notions such as welfare, such as equity, there is an inherent normative element to them. And I believe there's great value in making that transparent in the studies, and maybe also having studies that kind of present alternatives of what policy advice could be derived from a notion of efficiency as preference satisfaction versus a notion of efficiency as welfare, as increasing happiness, and a notion of welfare as improving the capabilities and opportunities that people have. So also that would help, in my view, policymakers and politicians to be much clearer about who they've been influenced by and what they actually want to implement and on what normative and descriptive basis.
Thanks so much, Francisca. That was so interesting. How hopeful are you about the future? Do you think that economics will start to take more account of moral philosophy?
I do believe there have been plenty of signs, and there's a lot of movement there at the moment. You may have heard of this initiative to go beyond GDP, for example. There have been a lot of economists coming together and consulting also with politicians at a very high level forum and discussing what alternatives are out there beyond measuring GDP, which arguably is just a very, quantitative indicator of consumption, but does not necessarily say something about whether those goods that were produced further our welfare and our well-being or preferences as a society, or they don't, right? Even the production of weapons, etc., all fall under GDP. And there are so many more indicators that you could look beyond that. I also think that moving away from an indicator, looking at consumption at a given point in time, but looking more at, okay, how do given countries invest, for example, into their natural capital, into their social capital, into their social cohesion and their society. That's something that could measure a whole lot of progress that we are not seeing at the moment by just looking at GDP and similar measures. So that's one dimension where I see there's been a lot of progress.
Thank you so much, Francisca. That was super interesting. I do have a question regarding measurability, I guess, and that's one of the most difficult things that I have in my work. A lot of the things that are super important in the philosophical sense are just very difficult to measure. One specific example is that, when we're working on mental health and how to find interventions that are super meaningful to other people's mental health. But at the same time, right, it's super difficult to mention someone's mental well-being. On one hand, you can obviously ask people to fill out a survey to self-report. But on the other hand, it's just, how do you measure someone who feels better? That's the key challenge, I guess, moving forward, integrating the two disciplines. For economists, they feel that if you can't measure it, then you can't compare A to B. If you can't compare A to B, you don't really know which one to go forward. For philosophers, I think that has a much different meaning in terms of what measurement is. What do you think of this, like the challenge of measurability?
I just wanted to say a comment on April's question. I think there are possibilities to define some kind of index that maybe captures well-being or something that we value better than just the GDP, which is, by the way, a product of the Great Depression. People needed to, they had a crisis and they didn't know what the hell was going on. So they had to develop this measure even at that time to be able to make some kind of relative statement about how much did we drop in production, something like that. But of course, this is useful in one context, maybe less useful in another context. When we talk about the well-being and the wealth of nations or cohesion of societies, as you said, something like the Gini index, which measures the inequality of wealth or income distribution, might be more handy. And I think that's something that also economists have been making maybe more use of lately. Piketty, for example, is a prominent advocate of, I mean, his books are full of Gini indexes and distributions. And for him, it's not about how much, but about how different we are. And so there are things that we can measure, right? I think the question is, which things do we take to be meaningful?
Yes, I agree with that. And what's there to measure, we can maybe take as, we can look at it like as the best approximation of what we actually want to achieve. And, you know, maybe we certainly won't be able to measure mental well-being the way that people feel about it in the end, but we can get closer to measuring something that's a correlate of it in the end, where you see that people are being more active and so forth, and then just try to promote these ends.
Well, thanks, Franziska. And I'm glad we've identified one area where philosophy can help economics. So what about another one? I think Jorge and April are going to talk now about what philosophy of science can teach experimental economics. So over to Jorge first.
As maybe some of you know, Esther Duflo and Abhid Banerjee won the Nobel Prize 2019, specifically for development economics. They were testing measures and programs about their effectiveness in increasing the welfare in one way or another. Now, what I have been looking at is at the validity of these RCTs, which for those who don't know, RCT is an acronym which stands for Randomized Control Trial, which is what used in the health sciences to measure the effectiveness of drugs by dividing some population in randomly into a treatment, into a control group, and giving the control group a placebo and the treatment the real drug, so you can say something about the effectiveness of the drug. Something similar was done, but with social programs, right? Now, those social programs, which arguably are more useful, more effective, and cheaper, are better to invest in. So goes the argument. One thing that we should also think about, and philosophers like Cartwright and Judea Pearl have been pointing at it, is that an experiment done somewhere on some population is not necessarily valid somewhere else on some other population. And we must somehow account for this difference in a more rigorous way. And there have been approaches and there have been proposals. I myself was working with the causal framework by Judea Pearl, but I don't think that this is necessary. I just think that we should just spare a thought about what do we do with experimental findings, especially if it's outside of the population, which is called the external validity of the experiment. Something that has been stressed not so much as the internal validity in economics, more specifically in econometrics, and that philosophers of science were right to point at.
Do you think the philosophers are just being a bit pedantic here, Jorge? It seems to be maybe the development economists, they just want to get on with it. And the philosophers should just, you know, accept that maybe it's not perfect, but it's the best that we have.
Philosophers are always kind of pedantic. That is true. However, I think in this case, they're right to be pedantic because it's about people. It's about real people. And it's about their lives. It may sound nice that some development economies are putting on some measures to help people, but at the end, who gives them the right to do things? And I think science, in some cases, is a good reason to do things. But then it must also be rigorous. And it's not rigorous if we don't think about these things that I've been pointing out. There's also a lot of money that goes into these programs. And I think economists would be all for it. We must invest the money so that get the highest rent out of it. That sounds a bit weird if we're talking about people, but no, I think to think about these things is actually very important, especially in developing economies.
Yeah, I think, Jorge, that's a really interesting point. The one that I've been thinking about kind of stems from what you said about both external validity of an experiment as well as the internal validity of an experiment. So external validity is basically how well can your finding from one locality translate to another locality. So for example, let's say Duflo, the infamous or the famous MIT J-PAL, had an experiment on mosquito nets in India, let's say. India could be considered a unique case. And the findings there can or cannot be translated into, say, Bangladesh or other African countries that are also in their experimental group. Now, that is very interesting insights, right? So what economists usually think about RCT is that it's the golden standard for discovering causal relationships. Now, the causal relationships have a local limit. What work in India might not work in, say, Cape Town, let's say, purely just because the populations that they're experimenting on are different. That's when external validity of an RCT is challenged. Internal validity is much more of a theoretical matter, and it mostly resolves around confidence level. Basically, the research standard is alpha equals 98%, which is, you know, 98% of the time we can be sure that this hypothesis is true or false. That has some really interesting consequences too. 98% is a pretty high number, according to, I think, I would say, a lot of policymakers. A couple of years ago, when I was in a seminar with some legislators, one question was posed, is like, why do we set alpha at 98? Why don't we set it at 60? That's all it takes to pass a bill. So why are you doing this and unnecessarily, you know, dictates a larger sample size? That's completely unnecessary. I think internal validity and external validity are important to be taken into consideration. And I think I want to propose a more practical perspective on this matter, particularly how do you actually communicate scientific discoveries? For example, how do you communicate J-PAL's discovery on mosquito nets really improve the health outcomes of people in India? Do you communicate it as researchers find the mosquito nets improve health outcome by 1/3? Or do you actually take into all the consideration of external and internal validity and you say something like much more boring, but also much more accurate? You know, mosquito nets in a small village in India increase the outcome of those people age 5 to 13 by about 26%, according to researchers functioning on a 98% confidence interval. Now, that is much more boring and much less catchy, but it's much more accurate. Say someone in South Africa might take that and say, hey, if it is just causal, we should just take it and run with it and actually have negative consequences. So I think one of the key implications of the problem that Jorge pinpointed to is how do you then communicate these hyper-scientific and expert finding to the public? What part do you leave out and what parts do you keep?
That's really interesting. Do you think there's maybe a compromise that you could strike between your very long headline and the punchy one?
I think there is, right? I mean, it actually goes back to Franziska's argument about how do we incorporate the fact that there are value judgments even in scientific experiments into the communication. Perhaps you can say something that highlights the causal relationship, but at the same time, I think at the very least, pinpoint the locality of it. So instead of just highlighting the causal relationship between mosquito nets and health outcomes, you can say that this happens definitely and will work well in India. And maybe you can even add something at the end of the press release and saying, more research needs to be done in other localities to make this a global finding.
Taking a slightly different angle on experimental economics, I feel that it has made its way back into philosophy in a very different way as well, in the form of effective altruism, where a lot of people now take, you know, their decisions to be altruistic, to do something good in the world based on such experiments and based on evidence of where you can get the most bang for the buck. What do you think about this approach of effective altruism? And is it constrained, you think, by the problems of external and internal validity as well?
So I would say that effective altruism is essentially what drives development in economics, right? We are trying to make some kind of change that increases the welfare of people. So if we try to evaluate these interventions that are supposed to do the change by RCT, then the external validities of these RCTs are essential to what you call effective altruism, since otherwise it would be quite ineffective, right? So our interventions. So of course, it's necessitated, so to speak.
I think is a different answer to Francisco's question, that this critique of RCTs that April and Jorge have made doesn't actually defeat effective altruism, but just shows that it should find better ways of gathering evidence and data about what really does the most good in the world. Great. So we've heard two different ways in which philosophy can help economics. And so probably to be fair, we should also think about what economics can teach philosophy. And I suppose we should caveat in saying that we're mainly philosophers. So maybe we're being slightly unfair on economics. However, I will have a go at saying one area in which I think economics can teach philosophy something. So economics was the first social science where maths was used in a widespread way to formalize the arguments. And nowadays, if you read economics journals, they're full of mathematical equations and graphs and that kind of thing. So I think there are some downsides to this. For example, economists might get obsessed by having beautiful maths and lose sight of the fact that they're trying to say something about the real world. And I know this is a problem that that economists have grappled with. So Amartya Sen, someone who we mentioned earlier in the conversation, said that the demands of tractability can conflict with those of veracity. And we can have a hard choice between simplicity and relevance, which I basically understand as saying that you can have a great theory in an economics journal, but actually that doesn't necessarily mean it's very useful in the real world. And there's a bit of a trade-off going on here. But I think that nonetheless, there are some benefits too in making arguments sort of more rigorous and formalized using maths. And I think this is mainly because you can stop people arguing cross purposes and make the debates a lot clearer. And I think that perhaps this is something that philosophy could do more of to make sure that our debates actually are going somewhere. And one area where I think that this could particularly be applied is in distributive justice, which is broadly an area of philosophy looking at how resources should best be distributed in the fairest, the most just way among different people in society. And there are loads of different theories of distributive justice, lots of isms. So we've got utilitarianism, egalitarianism, prioritarianism, sufficientarianism. There's even one called limitarianism quite recently. And I think there's a danger in the debates between these different schools of distributive justice that the differences in the theories aren't actually spelled out very clearly. And that just makes it difficult to hold a debate. So I'll quickly talk through an example, which I think demonstrates this, drawing on a famous thought experiment by the moral philosopher Thomas Nagel in a paper he wrote called Equality. So Nagel imagines there are a family with two children, one of which is healthy and happy, and the other who's suffering from a painful handicap. And the family has a choice. They can either move to a city where the second one would receive special treatment, making them a lot better off, or a suburb where the first child would flourish. And there's an important caveat here that the possible gain for the first child is substantially greater than the possible gain for the second child. So that's to say that sort of in overall welfare terms, just assuming that this is possible, this sort of healthy and happy child will benefit a lot more from moving to the suburb than the second child with the handicap would moving to the city. And nonetheless, Nagel says that moving to the city would be the better choice because it's more egalitarian. And so this is a really interesting thought experiment, I think, but actually it's one that subsequently other philosophers have come and challenged. And notably, the philosopher Derek Parfit, he argued that Nagel had misdescribed the thought experiment. And he said that Nagel had overlooked a distinction between equality and what Parfit called priority, by which he means that roughly that benefiting people who are worse off is important because they are at a lower absolute level rather than a lower relative level. So that means that We should say that moving to the city is the better choice, but that's not because it increases equality, it's because it's more urgent to help the handicapped child who's worse off. And I think that this case, it just shows how having these debates in words, it can lead to some confusions. And maybe if Thomas Nagel and Derek Parfit had taken a leaf out of the Economist books and they'd, you know, made some mathematical models or drawn some graphs, there perhaps wouldn't have been this confusion.
Rob, that was really interesting as a thought experiment. Do you think this is merely a matter of communication in a sense? Because I know that in economics, some some economists have tried to basically formalize what they've previously seen in philosophy. There's even something like the Rawlsian wealth function, where basically the difference principle has been formalized. And there's still debates about in which way you can do this best. But the formalizations are definitely there. So should there be more exchange, or is this a deeper problem where philosophers have to learn formalizing their thoughts?
Yeah, interesting. And I have seen some sort of promising signs of philosophers using maths a bit more. Maybe it's sort of an issue for some parts of philosophy, but then not for others. So I think that maybe some analytic philosophers might be a bit more comfortable operating in this academic environment, whereas you might get some other philosophers, maybe continental philosophers, who just feel that you can't use maths to describe philosophy, that it's sort of, there's something about the human condition that means trying to model it using maths is just wrong. But I think it will be interesting to see in the future how much more maths is used in philosophy, because it does seem that in other areas of social science, maths become more and more pervasive, notably in economics, but I think in other areas too. And maybe philosophy is just the next subject to be mathematized.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you're right that many discussions would be in existence because of the clarity that some mathematical expression would bring. On the other hand, we must also not forget that sometimes the mathematization of things leads to oversimplification. And I think that's something that maybe economists are more prone to than philosophers. But of course, using formal methods properly is a benefit, I believe. And I think logic is a good example of that. Modal logic, for example, is a powerful tool to make actually meaningful, to say meaningful things and to make arguments, although not, maybe it's still a thing that only logicians use. Maybe it should come more into the mainstream, I believe. However, I totally agree with you. And I also think that this is also a way of somehow finding the intersection between economics and philosophy, because both speak different languages. So this could be something in which they could come together, since they obviously are two separate communities with two separate dictionaries in a way.
And I think with that note of harmony between philosophers and economists, it's the end of our show. Thanks so much, Jorge, Francisca, and April, for a really fascinating conversation.